In the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and he took Gath and its surrounding villages from the control of the Philistines. David also defeated the Moabites, and they became subject to him and brought tribute. Moreover, David fought Hadadezer, king of Zobah, as far as Hamath, when he went to establish his control along the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, and 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 of them. He put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus, and the Arameans became subject to him and brought tribute. The Lord gave David victory everywhere he went. David took the gold shields carried by the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. From Teba and Kun, towns that belonged to Hadadezer, David took a great quantity of bronze, which Solomon used to make the bronze sea, the pillars, and various bronze articles. When Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent his son Hadoram to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory in battle over Hadadezer, who had been at war with Tou. Hadoram brought all kinds of articles of gold and silver and bronze. King David dedicated these articles to the Lord, as he had done with the silver and gold he had taken from all these nations, Edom and Moab, the Ammonites, and the Philistines and Amalek. Abishai, son of Zeruiah, struck down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David. The Lord gave David victory everywhere he went. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. Joab, son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Shavshah was secretary. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and Pelethites, and David's sons were chief officials at the king's side.
Well, I don't know about you, but one of the most memorable and moving war films that I have ever seen is Saving Private Ryan. And many of you may have seen that, you may feel the same as I do. And as you may know, it tells the story of a platoon of American soldiers who were in Europe during the time of the Second World War. And they are sent on a particular mission. They've got to try and rescue a small group of soldiers who have been left exposed to enemy attack while they are protecting a bridge. And in that group of exposed soldiers, there is a particular individual, Private Ryan, who is the focus of their attention, because it has been discovered he is the last remaining of four Ryan brothers serving in Europe. His three brothers have all been killed, and the authorities feel it's just too much for the fourth one to go down, so they then send this platoon to try and get those guys, including and particularly Private Ryan. And the platoon is led by a guy called Captain John Miller, played by Tom Hanks. He heads up the mission. And he and his platoon face many dangers in order to get to Ryan and his fellow soldiers. And when they arrive, they are involved in a terrible battle to hold the bridge. When all looks lost, reinforcements arrive, and the enemy is swiftly overcome. But whilst the battle was in full flow, Captain John Miller is shot, and he's lying in the street, propped up against an abandoned motorbike. People are calling for the medics, trying to get him help, but he's clearly not going to recover. At that moment, Private Ryan kneels next to him. He's trying to take in everything that's going on here, thinking about what this all means. Here is this man who bravely came out for him, who fought against the odds, and finally, at the cost of his own life, has succeeded in the task of saving Private Ryan. And then he realizes that the captain is trying to speak. He puts his ear close to the captain's mouth. The captain holds his collar and says, "Earn this. Earn it." It's amazingly moving. I looked at it again last night, just that scene on the bridge, to make sure I'd got the story right, and I had tears in my eyes. Imagine the responsibility on Ryan's shoulders as he walks away. Earn this, earn it, in his mind. At the end of the film, we see Ryan as an old man in his 70s. He's visiting the grave of Captain Miller. And you hear him say this: "I didn't know how I was going to feel today. Every day I remember what you said on the bridge. I've tried to be a good man. I tried to live a good life to earn what you all did for me that day." It's amazingly moving. Now, it's been suggested that Steven Spielberg, who directed that film, was really posing a question to the whole of Western society through the making of that film, Saving Private Ryan. Because it's almost as if he was saying, there were many Captain Millers who gave their lives to secure something for you, to secure your freedom. There were many silent heroes, as we heard from Pat, who saw liberty and democracy and other values something worth fighting for. But the question is, have we earned it? Have we taken advantage of the opportunities they secured for us at such great cost? That is a question, you might say, that Western civilization has to kind of answer. Have we earned it? Have we responded aright to the opportunities those who gave their lives have given to us? But if that question is appropriate for the whole of Western society today, that kind of question is even more appropriate to Christian believers. Think about it for a moment. We have been saved not from the Nazis and fascist ideology, but something far more terrible. Believers have been saved from the consequences of their sin. Believers have been saved from final death. We have been saved from judgment, from hell itself. And think about it, we've not been saved through the blood of men, but through the blood of the Son of God, the God-man himself, Jesus. You see, he had something in mind when he entered the battle for our lives. There was something that he knew was worth fighting for, not preserving Western civilization, but something far grander than that. He was saving a people to become something glorious, the universal church. Christian believers from all places and all times through history, a metaphorical building, glorious in its dimensions and adornments, joined together and rising, as we've been reading in our fellowship groups in Ephesians, to become a holy temple to the Lord, a dwelling in which God lives by his Holy Spirit. That's what Jesus was fighting for. That's what he won the victory for. That's what he came out in a mission for. For him, for Jesus, the church, was something worth fighting for. And the question he would put to each of us today is this: what have you done with the opportunity to be a part of that body? To be a part of that metaphorical building, to be a part of the universal church, glorious in its dimensions and adornments, joined together and rising to become a holy temple to the Lord, a dwelling in which God lives by his Holy Spirit. What have you done with the opportunity to be a part of all that? Now, I think as we turn to our passage in 1 Chronicles, that we can imagine King David asking the same kind of question to those who followed on after him. Because as we see in our reading this morning, David fought hard, risked his life and the lives of many others in order to secure the opportunity for a temple to be built in his day. Not a metaphorical temple, but a real one, physical. So our title this morning is simply this: Something Worth Fighting For. And we're taken back to great King David, the forerunner of the far greater David, son of David, the Lord Jesus. But they shared the same spirit and the same goal: to see God's temple being built. Something glorious with great adornments. Well, we're coming now into the second half of a 5-sermon series. I think I said last week it was 6, but there's only 5. I can't count, obviously. 5-sermon series looking at the life of David from the book of 1 Chronicles. And those who were with us last week will remember that David expressed a great desire to build a house, a temple, for the Lord. And the Lord said to him, "You're not the one who's going to do that, but I'm going to build a house for you." But he also intimated that his son, Solomon, was the one who was actually going to build the temple. But even though David will not actually build the temple, he does everything he can to prepare for its being built. And from this passage onwards, really for the rest of his life, as it's recorded in 1 Chronicles, David is simply focused on that temple, on its construction, on its administration. He's doing everything he can to provide for the building of that temple. And so even these different battles that we read about in chapters 18, 19, and 20 here have one thing in view: to secure the land, removing a host of ugly enemies, so that a safe space can be guaranteed for the building of the temple. So all these battles, you may notice that they kind of cover various different places, and there's some old enemies here, isn't there, really? Edom, Moab, Ammonites, Philistines, Amalek, and so on. They're all dealt with, these ugly enemies, you might say, so that the land can become secure and safe and a place of peace, so that the temple can be built. And towards the end of the book, he kind of explains this strategy. He gathers some of the leaders of Israel together, and this is what he says. It's going to be up on the screen. "Is not the Lord your God with you? And has he not granted you rest on every side? For he has handed the inhabitants of the land over to me, and the land is subject to the Lord and to his people. Now devote your heart and soul to seeking the Lord your God. Begin to build the sanctuary of the Lord your God, so that you may bring the Ark of the Covenant and the sacred articles belonging to God into the temple that will be built for the name of the Lord." So you can see the focus of all those wars, all those battles, and some of them are really, really difficult. I mean, read it yourself in chapter 19 and 20. They really are up against it. And yet they're victorious time and time and time and time again. The Lord gave David victory everywhere he went, we read. Why is this? To secure the land from the ugly enemies, so that there might be a place for the building of God's temple. And we can see that kind of focus on preparing for the building of the temple elsewhere in this chapter. You may have picked this up, but you may have noticed that every time David goes into battle, he ends up kind of capturing some goodies. And they're real goodies. Golden shields that were carried by the army officers of Hadadezer. Large quantities of silver and bronze and other precious metals. And what does he do with them? He doesn't put them in his bedroom. He doesn't build an extension to show off his medals. They're all to be gathered to be used in the temple of the Lord. So just look at chapter 18, verses 7 and 8. David took the gold shield carried by the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. From Tebar and Kun, towns that belonged to Hadadezer, David took a great quantity of bronze. What happened to that bronze? How did it get used? Solomon used it for the milking of making of a great bath thing called the sea, and the great bronze pillars and other bronze articles. It was all to be used in the temple. Look also at verse 9 and following. When Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent his son to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory. And he brought all kinds of articles of gold and silver and bronze. What did David do with those articles? Verse 11. King David dedicated these articles to the Lord, as he had done with the silver and the gold he'd taken from all these nations, Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, Amalek. From all of those nations that he fought against, he came away with plunder, the spoils of war. Gold, silver, bronze, many other precious things. And what does he want them all for? All for the temple. David wasn't going to build the temple, but he did everything else but. He does everything he can to provide for it. At the end of the book, again, David actually explains his strategy here. So look, here we've got another verse from the end of the book. With all my resources, I have provided for the temple of the Lord gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, onyx, turquoise, stones of various colors, and all kinds of fine stone and marble, all of these in large quantities. Well, it certainly would have been large quantities after invading all of those places. How can we sum up what's going on here? At great cost, let's put that on the board, shall we? At great cost, David created the safe space, and provided the materials for the temple. And now the responsibility is on those who came after him to build. He's done everything he can to provide the circumstances for them to build the temple. They're to take full advantage of that opportunity that's been given to them at great cost. We might even say, they have to earn it. To earn it. Now this morning, as we gather here, we remember that great David's greater son has done something similar, but far greater for us. Let's put that on the board, shall we, Andrew? At greater cost, Jesus has created the safe space and provided the materials for the temple, the church. And now the responsibility is on those who come after him to build. And Jesus might say to the likes of you and I this morning, I have won you peace with God. What are you going to do with it? Will you, as it says in Colossians, live a life worthy of the Lord, pleasing him in every way? Will you take your place in the building up of the church? Because we are the materials that God uses to build his universal church. Jesus has captured not gold and silver, bronze and turquoise, but men and women, boys and girls. He's captured us from his enemy for his temple, to adorn it. And the Bible talks about us as being living stones. We're to be, as it were, the gold and the silver that shine for him. We'll be those who overcome, who persevere in our faith in spite of many trials and difficulties. And as Jesus says in Revelation chapter 3, verse 12, we will be made a pillar in the temple of my God. He even talks about us as if we're actually part of a physical structure there. Jesus saw that his people, the universal church, the temple of his God, built for his name and praise, was worth fighting for. And the question simply to us this morning is, do we feel the same? Do we feel the same? He felt it was worth fighting for. He felt it was worth giving us this opportunity. What are we going to do with that opportunity? How will we respond to all that he's done to prepare for this great structure, the universal church, this morning? Well, before we finish, let me just suggest quickly three things. And I notice actually that they're all kind of things that are mentioned in the news sheet in one way or another this morning, so maybe that will be a little reminder to you. Firstly, let me just suggest this. If you're a Christian believer, can I encourage you to commit to join a local church? That may not necessarily be this local church, but just to commit to join a local church. Now, I know that there are some who are not church members who do a great deal to help us as a fellowship here, but I want to encourage everybody who is not a member just to think about it. And maybe if there have been things that have held you back in the past, maybe to try and deal with some of those issues that have held you back so that you can actually move forward on this matter. Maybe speak to people and just say, well, I've always had this issue. Is there any way in which we could talk about that so that you could help me over this so that I might be able to commit more fully to the life of this church or of a local church? Take a bigger part is really what we're saying in the building of the temple. Jesus has died for us so that we might be part of his temple. Take a part in the temple. Why not think about coming along to that breakfast next Saturday morning, having a word with Phil if you'd like to do that. Second thing I think we should just think about is this. Commit to serve in a local church. Now, what I mean by that is play a part. Do something. Join one of the teams. Think about how you could possibly increase what you do for Grove Hill Evangelical Church or another local church elsewhere. Don't be satisfied with just be part of a rota, just a name on a rota, but think about how you might take some responsibility. I think that's something that we can think about. I think we need to understand as a fellowship that, you know, it's not just one or two or a small group of people that should serve in the local church. Everybody should serve in some way or another. We are all part, as it were, of the body. Jesus has given us an opportunity to serve in his church. He considered it worth much for, fighting for. How do we view it? Are we wanting to contribute and play our part? Let me just say this. Maybe you're not in a position because of age and physicality or whatever to actually do much. I wonder whether you could just think of about a particular ministry of the church and commit to pray for that. Again, you might want to look through the news sheet, see the different things that go on here, and maybe say, well, that one I'd like to specifically pray for. Have a word with one of the leaders of that and say, how can you keep me up to date with how are things going in this particular ministry or that ministry? I want to pray more knowledgeably and carefully about that. And then I think thirdly, I just leave this with us, thirdly, commit to the growth of the church. Think about all that Jesus has done to make the church possible. Get excited about the prospect. It's not kind of dubious. Has he done enough? Has he not done enough? Do you think he's really got it together there? It's a bit like David. Everywhere he goes, he wins battles. Everywhere he goes, he gathers the spoils of war. We can have confidence, even in our own day and age, to keep speaking about Jesus, knowing that he's won the battle for the truth. He's won the battle over the philosophies of this world. He's claiming people as his precious items to be brought and adorned in the temple. Have confidence in that and commit to the growth of the church. Think about how you might then develop relationships with non-Christians for the sake of the gospel, because your confidence is in Jesus and his ability to build his church with men and women, boys and girls. Think about how you might encourage those who are involved in evangelism. Think about how you might pray for Rick and Esther, who are with us next weekend, moving into Clay Hall, Barkingside, to plant a church, to see the temple increase, to see more people, men and women, boys and girls, adorning the temple to the glory of God. Think about how you can support that. Think about that collection coming up on the 24th of November. And think about the missionaries we support. Think about how you might be up to date, reading their prayer letters, praying knowledgeably for them. They are fighting the battle, aren't they? They're on the front line to see the temple built because of all that Jesus has done to provide that opportunity. How are we getting alongside them in the battle? Something worth fighting for this morning. David had it in his mind and heart, but he was simply an echo of Jesus and his great desire to secure the space and all the materials to build a great universal church for the name of the Lord his God. What are we doing in response to that?